Today, answers matter more than ever before. That's why IBM is helping businesses manage customer questions with Watson Assistant. It's conversational AI designed to work for any industry. Let's put smart to work. Visit ibm.com/Watson Assistant.
Sedano with you here on 710 ESPN, presented by Progressive Insurance. All our guests appear via the Shell Pennzoil Performance Line. Amin's going to join us in just a second. Byron Scott at 11:30. This segment brought to you by our friends at My Computer Career, training for a better life. So I just retweeted something because I think it was pretty hilarious. I just told you in the last segment that the NFL GMs, I guess, are having issues already and glitches with their test run of their virtual draft. And I retweeted someone because I thought it was funny. It says, I'm seriously asking why the NFL just can't use the ESPN Fantasy app. I'm telling you, man, just use that, because this technical, you're asking a bunch of old guys to use technology. It's going to be hilariously a disaster. Now, Amin Alhassan, ESPN NBA front office insider, friend of the program, was in a front office and worked with a lot of old guys who probably weren't technologically savvy. So before I even get to The Last Dance, I feel like the NFL draft, this virtual draft, is going to be a complete disaster. Like, in the sense of, it's going to be funny because these guys aren't going to know the technology. They're going to mess this thing up. It's going to be like your worst fantasy draft coming to life.
Yeah, it's weird, George. And by the way, congratulations on that intro that had Push It to the Limit from Scarface playing. I really enjoyed that.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
The way we used to do the draft in the NBA is everyone's in a group chat. It used to be a conference call, right? And then they're like, when they realize, hey, we can do this in print, in typing, you can just have everyone in a group chat and everyone kind of logs in and you type in, you know, like Chicago's on the clock, and you type in, okay, we're taking, Denzel Valentine or whoever, and you keep it moving. And that's why it was always surprising to me that people were so blown away that newsbreakers would know who the pick would be before the commissioner announces it. It's real easy. The group chat happens like a full, like 3 or 4 minutes ahead of what's being announced on TV. So all you need is one person in one war room to text you, okay, they just took Valentine. Okay, they just took so-and-so. And that's all you need. So it's not that much of a wizardry or whatever. But in terms of if the technology is that confusing for everybody, why not just have everyone back on the conference call? You call it in. You pick up the
right.
Well, I did one of these with the league the other day with Commissioner Silver's address to the media.
Yeah.
You call in. There's a code, and they know your name, and the code is specific to who you are.
Yeah.
And then, like, when you want to say something or ask a question, you dial *1, and then it knows who dialed *1, and it knows when the operator says, okay, Amin Alhassan, next question, no one else's line is going to go open and say, hey, yeah, this is Amin Alhassan, and I want to know why you suck. You know, like, it's only going to be my line that's open. They can do that for the draft. I don't know why they're trying to complicate this thing. I guess, is it because of cameras and stuff? Because they want this to be televised? I don't know.
Yeah, I think that probably has something to do with it. But right, you could do both. Like, you could still have the phone thing and just make it, you know, and then do the pick on the Zoom or whatever the hell they're going to do. But I think it is literally going to be your fantasy draft nightmare, where, you know, the guy, you're in the fantasy draft and somebody's on auto draft by accident and takes the wrong guy. Stop, pause the draft. I took the wrong guy. I didn't mean to take, Edgerrin James. I meant to take Emmitt Smith or whatever. I mean, I don't even know if there was fantasy back then.
That's the funny thing is that they're doing a dry run, right? And the dry run, the teams are all drafting people who are already retired and stuff, right?
Right.
It's just to see if the system works, not necessarily reveal who you're going to take.
Yeah. Good Lord. So anyway, a text from a GM from Diana Rossini, by the way, just so we can move on from this. ESPN NFL Insider, about the mock draft. There are early communication issues because 32 of us GMs are on a conference call and we didn't hit the mute. Sounds awful. So there you go. I mean, trying to use the phone and they don't have that, the ability to have one person talk at a time.
But the league does. That's my point. Just like Commissioner Silver's address to the media on Friday, if I could have started babbling, it doesn't matter. They would have muted my line because they have the ability to mute the individual line.
Yeah. So anyway, let's talk Last Dance. So of course, you know, social media is undefeated, and you know they got to find something negative. It's like you'll never find a poll that'll hit 100% on anything. So there are people out there say, "We just look like you were kissing Michael Jordan's butt, ESPN. What do you have to say about that? It was just a butt kissing." All right, I mean, you lived this like I did. We're about the same age. Like, what did you make of what you saw yesterday?
It was remarkable. It was, look, here's the deal, George, because it's not just because I lived it, like, as a fan or whatever. Like, I lived it because a lot of the stuff, this is stuff you learn about as you are working in the industry, because you may come up with parallel situations or similar situations. And so the idea is that many of this stuff was stuff that I knew. I knew Jerry Krause had the whole, you go 82-0, I knew that Phil Jackson was going to get fired at the end of that year because they made it absolutely clear publicly. This isn't a behind-the-scenes thing. I knew Scottie Pippen wasn't happy about his contract, and I remember him pointing at people like Jim McElvain and you know, Luke Long and all these people getting paid more than him. I knew that Michael Jordan was a crazy competitor because his brother used to bully him and stuff like that, and he was competing for his father's attention. Like, I'm not going to say that, oh, it was so groundbreaking. But here's the thing. There's a difference between knowing the story and watching the story. Watching this dude go for Danny Ainge during the playoffs. Like, there's a difference. You could have told me. I didn't know that. I didn't know he golfed between game one and game two of that series with Danny Ainge. But even if you told me that story, even if I read it in a book before, there's a difference between reading it and seeing the video in front of your eyes. I hate you people. I hate the internet because you guys ruin everything. Sometimes, you know, that's why I said, yo, you don't like it? Just go watch the 30 for 30 on Gordon Gierichek or someone like that. Go be a nerd somewhere else because that was absolutely cool last night.
Yeah, HP Basketball, we're talking to you.
Tell me Ethan Strauss, too. Who's too much of a coward to tweet it publicly. So he texts me these things.
Oh, Ethan Strauss, who we had on last week to discuss The Winning Machine, his book about the Warriors dynasty, which was fantastic. He is a negative Nancy about everything, no, that he's, guy.
He's not a negative Nancy. He's a contrarian. That's what he is. Not negative. He's just a contrarian. So everybody fawned over last night. Ethan wants to be the guy to remind us why fawning over this is kind of silly because there's nothing really new that we didn't learn last. Oh, shut up, Ethan.
Well,
shut up,
and my other
Moore. Shut up, all you people.
My other position on it is it's only 2 episodes of 10.
Yeah.
Like, relax.
one of my friends said, "I don't think it's going to be like that great." I'm like, what do you mean? And he says, "Well, like the OJ documentary, you got like murder and high speed car chases, the Michael Vick documentary, you have dog fighting." I'm like, so, like, only if high crimes are committed, that's the only way the content could be good?
Yeah. I mean, good Lord. So, anyway, there are people also saying that you shouldn't dunk on a dead guy with Jerry Krause. My position on that is this. Every story needs a villain. And by the way, I don't feel like some people who felt like they glossed over the stuff he did that was good, like putting that team together. As a matter of fact, I felt like they came back to that several times because I rewatched it yesterday. I mean, after it was over, mm-hmm. they ran it on ESPN2 an hour later, and I watched it over again. After seeing the reaction from some people on the internet, I said, well, let me look to see if that's the case. And I think that people get caught up in the emotion of it initially, but when you watch it back with a more watchful and perceptive eye, I think you notice they did a really good job acknowledging that he built the team, but he was also a bit of a klutz from a PR perspective. And yeah, like the guys didn't like him for good reason.
So George, this is one of those things where having the gift of hindsight is great. Yes, I think they dunked on him a little too hard last night. They dunked on a dead man a little too hard last night. But you know why? It's because they were dunking on him when he was alive.
Right.
Hell, go back and watch Michael Jordan's Hall of Fame speech. He dunks on Jerry Krause in that one. Like,
right.
So this is not about dead or alive, although like I do think they piled on definitely. But it is about like this guy who was partially responsible for the success was also greatly responsible for the downfall. But you know what I did think? I did think that Jerry Reinsdorf got off a little too easy.
Oh, he skated so much.
He skated because he's the, if you ask me, he's the one, right? When we had Roger Bell on with us this morning on SiriusXM NBA Radio. And Roger told the story, and this is, it was, I won't lie, it was a little uncomfortable for me because I was working for the Suns at the time and I knew all of this stuff. But Roger tells a story about signing a deal like Scottie Pippen because at that time he hadn't made real money yet in the league. This is how he was going to take care of his family and da-da-da. It was a five-year deal. And he says, 2 years into the deal, I'm first-team all-defense in the NBA, and I led the league in three-pointers. So he's like, I want a new deal. I want to rework the deal. And so he says, he goes to lunch with Robert Sarver, the owner of the Suns, and he says, Robert says, Roger, I agree with you. You are underpaid. I agree with you. You know, yeah. Well, we could change a deal, but we won't. And would you like to know why? And Roger says, why? And he says, because I don't have to. And ladies and gentlemen, that is an example of awful, awful management. I think Roger told the story from the standpoint of it's tough, but that's the business. But I'm here to tell you as a front office guy that that's not necessarily the way the business needs to be, because if you take care of this problem ahead of time when it's not critical condition time, you get to extend your run. And as Roger pointed out, Roger was a good NBA player, starting NBA player, but he wasn't a generational talent like Scottie Pippen. Like, you may not make that exception for Roger Bell, but you damn sure do it for Scottie Pippen when he's been such a big part of your success as an organization and has already been recognized as one of the 50 best players of all time. And it's not like he's 35. Dude's in his prime. You take care of him so that you extend that runway. And that commentary by Jerry Reinsdorf last night was the smoking gun of like, oh, yeah, y'all can blame Jerry Krause, but it's Reinsdorf's fault for most of this stuff.
For sure. Again, the buck stops with the owner. Now, I'm not intimately...
George, hold on, George, real quick. He hired Jerry Krause from his baseball team. Can you imagine
right.
that? It's like,
yes.
Hey, man, I want to be GM of your team. What are your qualifications? Well, I've been working in this other sport. You know what? I like you. Come on over. How nuts that is.
Right. I get it. It's crazy when you think about just the way that whole thing came about. But let me ask you this, because I'm not intimately familiar with the CBA from the 90s, right? But like, could he have restructured that deal? Could they have torn that up and done a new deal?
Yes, they could have. Back then, a lot of the rules we see in the CBA today started in 1998, which after the lockout.
Right.
So you can't restructure, you can't renegotiate, all those things, like rookie scales. A lot of that stuff came in 1998. So back then, yes, you could restructure. They could have renegotiated. They could have put an option in there where he can opt out. They could, you know, they could have given him a balloon payment. And so tacking on years at the end of the deal, but now he's getting more money in the current years. They had a lot more flexibility to do stuff in the olden days.
Oh, man. Then, yeah. Look, as much because no, I was.
He didn't do it because he didn't want to, or because he didn't have to, excuse me. He didn't do it because he didn't have to, not because of any other reason. They were making money hand over fist.
Now, let me ask you this, because that changes the way I view all of this. At least it does. Actually, you know what? Do you have another segment in you so I can finish this conversation?
We'll
continue this because this changes the way I view a lot of the things, including the way I view Michael's reaction to Scottie's contract. So let's get to some of that. Amina's sticking around. Byron's going to join us at 11:30. Sedano, 710 ESPN. Sedano with you here on 710 ESPN, presented by Progressive Insurance. All right, so Amin continues with us here on the show. So you have just now, since you explained to me that prior to the 1998 lockout and the CBA, you were allowed to renegotiate. You were allowed to be a little more, judicious with the way you handled contracts. So Scottie does have a legitimate gripe and a legitimate beef. He shouldn't have been the 122nd most paid, highest paid player in the NBA. But here's the thing. So I was originally on the side of, well, you signed the contract, and I get why he signed the contract, especially when you look back at his family history and the situations he was dealing with. But, now that I know that and I'm armed with that, and I also look at Jordan, and I was having this conversation with callers earlier where, you know, people were like, I could see why Jordan wouldn't want to say anything and put himself out there for Scottie. And I'm like, well, life is about leverage. And if you're the guy with leverage, and no one had more leverage than Michael Jordan at that time, even as much as he had a contentious relationship with ownership in the front office, like, you lean on them publicly. It may or may not work. It didn't work with Phil. Like, he went in and said, I'm not playing if Phil's not playing. and they called him on his bluff, and then he retired. But he could have at least publicly backed Scotty, which then changes the way I look at Jordan a little too. Does it do that for you?
No, because this is the Michael Jordan that I always kind of believed existed. Look, here's the greatest kind of parallel I can give to illustrate this. I recently watched A Kid from Coney Island, which is a documentary about Stephon Marbury. And in it, they talk about how Kevin Garnett got, at the time, the richest contract in sports. And right after that, that's when the lockout happened and all the owners freaked out and they came back with these maximum salaries that we have today in the NBA. And when Stephon was coming up on his extension, he got the maximum, which, because of the rules, was somewhere like either a half or two-thirds of what Garnett got, right? And Stephon was upset about that. And everyone in the documentary was interviewed, and these are his family members and friends, are like, yeah, it's not a referendum on how they feel like as a player. These are the rules now. They can't. They, by definition, they cannot pay you what Kevin Garnett gets. Even
right.
if they think you guys are every bit the equal. And so it's kind of ridiculous for you to be mad at ownership or management and say, oh, you got to trade me because you guys could not do more than what the rules allowed you to do. That's not the case here. The rules absolutely allowed them to pay Scotty more to renegotiate his deal, and they decided not to, not because they were bound by the collective bargaining agreement, but because they ain't feel like it, right? And that's an important distinction to remember. With regards to Michael Jordan, yeah, Michael Jordan has always been a guy who lives by two sets of rules, the rules that apply to him and the rules for everybody else. Sometimes those rules stink for him, a.k.a. the Jordan rules. I get beat up by the Detroit Pistons every time I go to the hole and nary a whistle call, right? And sometimes the rules work in your favor. Like, for instance, my contract is up, so I can make these $30 million per year paychecks. And that's right, ladies and gentlemen, in 1997 and 1998, Michael Jordan was making upwards of $30 million a year. He, by himself, made more than every other Chicago Bull salary on the roster for the last 2 years. Think about that. And so in Michael's eyes, we're here to win a championship, and you're letting the business part of it seep into the locker room and affect and impact my chances of winning another championship. That's all Michael cares about, if we're going to be completely honest. Yes, he said, you guys should cherish Scottie Pippen. That's all well and good until it comes to a point where it gets in the way of what Michael Jordan wants. And at that point, nah.
Yeah. At least he keeps it real, right? There's no way about that. Like, there's no other way around that. All right, let me bring this to more modern-day stuff. The one thing I noticed is, it's funny, right? Because, and I think it's the era that you play in, and the coverage obviously changes and things like that. And there's a lot of factors, right? But if I'm Kobe Bryant up in the sky right now, I'm looking at Michael Jordan yelling at Ron Harper. I'm looking at him mother bleeping Tony Kukoc. And clearly we know that we'll get to the episode where he punches Steve Kerr in the face. And I'm like, wait a second. I took a lot of grief for pushing out Mush Parker and yelling at him. Like, what the hell happened here? How come I didn't get some of this love that Michael Jordan was getting for being the quote unquote ultimate leader guy?
Well, I think that's a fair point. And my point would be, I don't think the way Michael led was right either. I don't think that was being a great teammate, for one. That's one thing. Like, people equate that with great leadership. But I think we've seen great leadership in Tim Duncan and Kevin Garnett and Dwayne Wade and LeBron James. And there are a lot of guys who have not led that way and been very successful in this league. The idea that that's how you lead and anything else is not leading, or anything else is not competitive, or anything else is not, like, acceptable. And that's the problem, I think. And so I wasn't a fan of how Michael treated his teammates, and I wasn't a fan of how Kobe treated his teammates. The other thing, though, I would say is, much like many of the other Kobe-Michael comparisons, Kobe did, like, a shadow version of what Michael was doing. So Michael did that to his teammates, but guess what he also did? He went out to dinner with them. He was social with them. He could be charming and friendly. And the stories, many of the stories about Kobe is stories of aloofness, of the, like, there's no good cop, bad cop in him. It was just, I'm going to be angry, da, 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 and then I'm going to leave and I'm going to hang out with my family, which, again, that's cool. That's his prerogative and that's what he wants to do. But let's not equate the two styles together, I guess is what I'm saying.
The other thing that's come up is obviously you knew this would happen. I mean, it was on Get Up this morning. LeBron versus Jordan. But they had Stephen A. on there. They had Jalen on there. Greeny was refereeing in between. But Kendrick Perkins had an interesting tweet. Bergman, what was the tweet that Kendrick had earlier?
So Kendrick Perkins says, the expectations of LeBron is like nothing we've ever seen in NBA history. If Bron scores 63 and 49 in a series and gets swept, every sports network is talking about his inability to get it done, while MJ is getting praised and awarded player of the game in losses.
How do you view that tweet? Do you agree with him or no?
So one of the fun things about this documentary is for many of the older guard, it was like, okay, wait till you young guys watch. You see how it really was back how we were, da da da. And some of it is yes, and some of it is like, oh no, nothing has changed, right? And so Perk is right in that LeBron would have got skewered if that happened, right? If that, you know, 49-63 and then 18, I believe, in the 19 in the third game of the sweep. Oh, he choked, they locked it down, whatever. Absolutely. But guess what, Perk? They were saying those things about Michael Jordan, too. They're saying, all he does is shoot. He never passes. He's selfish. He's right. Not a winner. He'll never get it done. I can pull right now the NBA on NBC intro where Marv Albert literally lists all the great athletes who have never won a championship. And then there's Michael Jordan. Is he going to join O.J. Simpson and Ernie Banks and all these other Bob Lanier, these greats who never won jack bleep ever in their life? Right? That was happening. That conversation about Michael Jordan happened then, much as it happened about LeBron now. The other part I would say is never, ever, ever do I want to hear an old player say, back in my day, we weren't friends. We went out there, we tried to kill each other, all that stuff. Because there's Michael Jordan golfing with Danny Ainge.
Yeah.
Between games one and game two of that series. And by the way, it's not like he's golfing with Charles Oakley or, you know, some lifelong friend like James Worthy. He's golfing with Danny freaking Ainge. When did y'all become homeboys? Where are you going to go out golfing together? But he did that. You know why? Because players were friends back then, and players are friends now. And everything that you guys moan about, like, never happened back in the day, guess what? It happened all the time.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, Magic and Isaiah, I mean, we saw them kiss, right? Like, you know what I'm saying? And hug. Yeah. And yet they still were unbelievable competitors and vicious to each other while in between the lines, you know?
It's almost like that doesn't have any factor on the other thing, right? Oh, what, really? Like, you mean, like, being friends doesn't change how competitive and maniacally psycho I am when it comes to a game? Oh, imagine that.
Yeah, it is interesting, but you're right. People that don't, unless they watch this documentary, and I don't think they focused enough on the early Jordan stuff about the ball hog and he'll never win that way, not being a team player. Like, they didn't, I was stunned there wasn't some of that. At least at this point, I haven't seen any of it or enough of it.
Yeah, no, they definitely did not mention it. They just made it seem like he got there and everything started turning around.
Yeah,
even when he said he went at the – when I got there, I went out and sought out the team leader, and I went at him hard every day.
Right.
They don't really talk about, like, how uncomfortable that was because he had a similar thing that happened to LeBron. You know, like, that infamous video of, like, Ricky Davis and Darius Miles saying, yeah, maybe this rookie can come off the bench and help us win a couple of games.
Right.
I'm talking about LeBron.
Yeah.
Like, it's so preposterous because at that moment, he's already better than all of them. But Jordan went through that too, where like this whole like who does he think he is thing, and the vets kind of shunned him.
Amin Alhassan, ESPN NBA front office insider. Thanks for stopping by, brother. Appreciate it as always. We'll talk soon.
No problem.
See ya. There he is. There's Amin. This segment presented by Progressive Insurance, home of the Home Quote Explorer, giving you multiple quote options so you can pick what's right for you. See for yourself at progressive.com. So coming up next, Byron Scott is going to join us. Sedano with you here at 710 ESPN, presented by Progressive Insurance. All our guests appear via the Shell Pennzoil Performance Line. Byron Scott going to join us in a bit. Oh, man. That was fun with Amin. I can't wait to talk to Byron, who played against Jordan, obviously. And I'd love to see how Byron kind of viewed that. And look, we haven't really gotten, I know they had it in the opening scene where they were beating the Lakers and all the different championships like quickly, but they're going to get to that series. And a series, if I recall correctly, that Byron got hurt in, along with James Worthy. So I want to hear if Byron's got some thoughts on that series in retrospect. Is he on now? Oh, there he is. Byron Scott, Lakers legend joining us here, friend of the program. Byron, first of all, how's everybody doing? Everybody safe and healthy?
George, how you doing, first of all? Everybody is safe and healthy. Just doing what our governor is talking about doing, which is staying home. And we're having a lot of fun doing it, to be honest with you. Not getting bored, so everything's good.
Yeah, I hear you. Look, the interesting part of this is that it does give us a little more family time that we probably would have never gotten, right? Like, that's the silver lining, I look, at this particular point.
Absolutely. I think, you know, it gives you a chance also to reflect on a lot of things that's going on in your everyday life. And for me, it's really gave me a chance to just slow down, you know, just sit still for a minute and like you said, enjoy the family time that you have.
Yeah, slow down is a perfect word for it, right? Because we were definitely running. We were all sprinting in life, and every once in a while, you need to stop, take a deep breath, smell the fresh air, and boy, is there a lot of fresh air right now, Byron, without 15 million cars on the road. We went from the worst air quality in America to the best air quality in America in a month. It's kind of nice, I got to be honest.
It's unbelievable. I'm sitting at home, and I'm in Hermosa Beach, so I'm looking outside, and I've never seen this far and the air this clear. You know, I can see the ocean and it seems like I could see forever. So the air quality right now is the best it's ever been since I've been here. I know that.
It's pretty crazy. Byron, so obviously everyone was watching the Last Dance documentary yesterday. There's so many aspects to this, but, you know, Magic was in there talking about he could see Michael coming and Larry and all these guys, right? Pat Riley, your coach. How did you view him when he entered the league?
Well, when he first entered the league, I viewed him as just an unbelievable talented player that had very few weaknesses. I think his only weakness that I thought of at that time was that he was very inconsistent with his jump shot. But it wasn't that you could say, let's force him this way or that way, because he could do either way, you know, going to his left or going to his right very effectively, get to the basket. He could, you know, he could dunk on you or he can go around you and reverse it. I mean, he was just so good and so gifted that I know in his early part of his career when I had to guard him, you know, I remember one day telling Riles, because he wanted to deny him everywhere, just don't let him get the ball, but yeah, he was so smart and he understood the game so well that if you did that, then he's going to go back door. So I suggested, let me just let him catch it and let me just play off and force him to shoot jump shots. And that particular game, it worked pretty well. He went 6 for 26, but it didn't work that well after that, because he started being able to hit shots on a consistent basis. And when he started doing that, it was just, you know, he had no weaknesses. You just hoped he missed shots. It was almost like guarding Kareem, I'm sure, from a center standpoint, where when he turned for that sky hook, you just hoped he missed because there wasn't nothing you could do about it. Well, same thing with MJ. You know, once he elevated and he was falling away already, you know, all you could do is hope he missed.
Take me back to that series, Byron, where you guys are playing them in the NBA Finals. You know, what's funny now is because, you know, it's so long removed now from that, that, you know, you guys were the favorite in that series and they were looked at as the villains, like the young team trying to steal what you guys owned, right? Like, it was kind of weird the way those dynamics worked back then that people don't remember.
Yeah, I never looked at them as the villain. I just looked at them as a young up and coming team that had, you know, went through their battles with Detroit in Boston, and sometimes you got to lose those battles before you can win the war. And I think they had got a lot of scars from previous series that really got them primed for this particular series, you know, when we played them in the finals. You know, unfortunately for us, you know, James wasn't 100%. You know, his knee was bothering him. I got hurt in, I think, game one. Mm-hmm. And didn't play the rest of that series. But that team was – they were driven. They were hungry. They were primed, you know, to win a championship. And at that particular point, you know, Michael had already, you know, arrived. You know, he had already been, you know, looked at as one of the best, if not the best player in the NBA at that time. And they kind of looked at him, I think, you know, the other MJ, Magic, my boy, and Larry is the guy who was going to take the torch. And then you had Scotty, who was, you know, starting to arrive as well. So I think at that particular time, that team was just primed. They were hungry. It was just no stopping them at that time.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's no question. I mean, you guys got game one, And, look, I know you guys were dinged up, but you had to feel at least confident that you had a chance because game three went to overtime. Like, I remember it. Yeah. You guys had a chance to really take a lead in that series.
Yeah. I mean, we knew we had a chance. It was just a matter of, we had to have some things go right. And, game three, like you said, we had a great opportunity to win that game, and we didn't win that game. And I think, from their standpoint, the Bulls, when they took game three and went up 2-1, it was like, listen, let's put our foot on their necks, which is the way we thought as well. If we had a team down, let's put our foot on their necks and let's press it down. Let's not let up. And they went on to win the next two games.
You know what happened, though, in that series is that, you had a lot of big men there, and they were a perimeter-oriented team. So you had some dead weight, like that Michael Thompson guy, who barely played in that series.
Yeah, you know what? Every team has their dead weight. Every team goes through that, So RMT, Michael Thompson, as much as I give him crap, he's still one of the best. I swear to God, one of the best. Acquisitions Jerry West made was bringing that guy to our team because he gave us that inside presence on the defensive end, and he could guard pretty much anybody defensively on the post. I mean, he was really so good defensively, it was scary. But, that series, like I said, as good as we were, we were banged up and we were getting of age, and that team was that young, aggressive, hungry, Scotty. I remember Scotty picking up Magic 94 feet. I mean, you could just see that they were just as much as we wanted it, they probably wanted it a little bit more.
Byron Scott joining us here, Laker great here on the Sedano Show on 710 ESPN. And, then after that, you went to Indiana and you had to face them again in the postseason a number of times.
You know what? I enjoyed the facing them just twice a year. Then I go to Indiana, I got to face them four times, so I got to see MJ on four different occasions every year for the next two or three years. But it was fun. It was fun because we had a really good team in Indiana. Obviously, the Bulls were great. The one year that he retired and then he came back, his first game was against us, in Indiana, and we beat him on national TV. But, if you're a competitor, and we had one of the great competitors too, in Reggie Miller. I mean, you talk about a guy that, as we called him Thin Man, you talk about a guy who got up for MJ. I mean, he looked forward to the challenge because he knew, just like we all knew, you're playing against the best.
Oh, you know, Byron.
So look forward to that challenge.
The trash talk between those two must have been epic. Like, man, what was that like to be on the floor with those guys?
You knew both of them was going to. The thing about MJ, he didn't talk trash until you started. And now once you started, he was going to go in and you'll go all in. And Reggie, he was going to talk no matter what. You don't have to start with Reggie. Reggie's going to talk, and that was just him. So just those two guys going at each other and talking, and you knew the offense was focused around those two. We focused our offense in Indiana around Reggie Miller because he was so damn good. And obviously the same thing in Chicago with MJ, even though the triangle, you're not supposed to be able to just really focus on one guy. But you have ways in the triangle offense of manipulating where that ball is going to be and whose hand is going to be in. So you knew it was going to be MJ's hand. And so those two guys going at it was man, it was you almost would almost stop playing just to listen to them. I mean, you had to realize that, wait a minute, we're playing against these guys. We got to keep playing. But just to listen to those two go at it, and there was no blood loss between those two. I mean, they really, really went at each other every single time they played.
Byron Scott joining us here, Laker great here on the Sedano Show on 710 ESPN. When he retired, though, and came back, that I know that's the season when you were in Indiana, you guys lost to the Magic in a seven-game series. They end up Shaq and Penny go to the NBA Finals and lose to the Rockets. Did you think, you said you guys beat him in your first game back, or in his first game back. Like, did you think he was still going to be Michael Jordan at that point, though?
Yeah, I did. I mean, he only took a year off, and it was still in his prime. So when he came back, he was rusty, when we played him on that afternoon. You could tell, though, that he was going. It was going to take him a week or two, and he was going to be the same old MJ that we knew. And I think it happened probably about a week later where he was in Madison Square Garden and just tore them up. So we knew it wasn't going to take him long. It wasn't like he sat out two or three years. He sat out for basically a year. And, that competitive nature that he has, we knew wasn't going to let him, let that last long. So I think we all knew that he was going to be the same Michael Jordan he was before he left for baseball when he came back.
Byron, you know what I felt like? I felt like that documentary for young people, right, was educational in a lot of ways, but particularly for Laker fans, because you're seeing the guy Kobe wanted to emulate. You know, you were around Kobe as a young man. You coached him. Like, what kind of similarities could you draw between those two guys?
Well, I'm telling you this, George. People that are watching this documentary of Michael and seeing how driven he was, seeing how he treated his teammates, seeing how he pushed his teammates, you're looking at, you know, Kobe, whatever, 10, 20 years ago. I mean, that was him, not to the point where he berated his player, but he challenged guys. He wanted to know, you know, and I'm talking about Kobe, he wanted to know who he can be in a foxhole with. You know, he wanted to know who he could go to war with. And he was going to test you every single day of practice. And that was MJ. You know, a really good friend of mine, Darryl Walker, who played with Chicago, used to tell me stories that, man, this dude would punch people in practice, you know, but he did it to find out who he can go to war with. You know, he wanted to test your heart. And great leaders, you know, have different mentalities out there on the court during practice. You know, Irvin, Magic Johnson, it wasn't like that. He would jump on you, but he did it in a way where he was really trying to encourage you to get the best out of you, and that worked for him, and it worked for us. You know, MJ was totally different, you know, and both guys are, you know, extremely successful. So, you know, when you're looking at this documentary, this is you're looking at a lot of what Kobe Bean Bryant was all about, and that's basically who he learned from was Michael Jordan. So you're watching, two of the greatest that ever played a game, and how they really went into every practice, went into every game, how they prepared mentally as well as physically, how they challenged themselves and their teammates and their coaches and front office. I mean, those guys didn't leave anybody out. You know, nobody was everybody was vulnerable to get, you know, a tongue lashing from those guys. So that's how you have to look at it.
So you're telling me that Kobe Bryant almost maybe one day might have thought about punching Marcelo Huertas or some Ryan Kelly or someone like that?
Yeah, if they would have messed up in practice to a certain extent where he was on their team, yeah, I saw him throw elbows to guys in practice. But again, he would throw elbows sometimes and hit you in the chest and then wink at the other guys who was in front of him just to see if he can get a reaction out the guy. I mean, that was just Kobe. You know, again, he wanted to find out who he can go to war with.
For sure. Byron with us here. Byron Scott, Laker great. When were you aware of their relationship? Because, I mean, I don't know how many of us knew what the depths of their relationship was until Michael talked at the memorial service. But, you know, you were around him. Did you know that those two were pretty close?
No, I didn't. George, I mean, that was, you know, MJ talking about, you know, the phone calls and the conversations that they had at the memorial. I was sitting there like, wow, I didn't know their relationship was that tight. And you could tell it was that tight. When you looked at MJ at the memorial and how he was crying and the heartfelt messages that he said and the things that he said about KB as his little brother and, you know, the advice that he would give him, and you could tell that they had a relationship that lasted for a while, you know, and I don't think a lot of people knew that. You know, obviously Michael didn't make it known and Kobe didn't go around bragging on his relationship with Michael Jordan. It was just something that those two had between themselves. And you could tell they talked a lot about basketball and probably about life in general. So it was really good to hear, you know, some of those stories from Michael, you know, about his conversations with Kobe. And again, like you said, I had no clue they were that close, but it was really great to hear.
Byron Scott, Laker great, joining us here on the Sedano Show on 710 ESPN. Byron, it's great to catch up with you again. I'm glad everyone's safe and sound, and hopefully we can catch up again soon.
George, anytime, my man, and make sure you stay inside as much as possible, too, and keep enjoying the family.
Will do, sir. Take care. Great talking to you again, my friend.
You too, George.
There he is, Byron Scott, Laker great with us here. All right, coming up next, we've got Clayton Kershaw making news. We'll tell you what that's all about. And Bergman has the origination of why today is 420 and why everyone wants to toke it up. We'll explain that next. Sedano, 710 ESPN. Sedano with you here on 710 ESPN. Thanks to Byron Scott, who joined us there. Talk about The Last Dance. Tune into the behind-the-scenes look at the 90s Bulls dynasty. The series continues Sunday at 6 o'clock on ESPN. Listen to the wrap-up show with me and Sliwa immediately following the broadcast. Presented by State Farm, AT&T, Coors Light, and Cinco Tequila. And, of course, we're giving you the Straight Talk, brought to you by Straight Talk Wireless. Everything for less, only at Walmart. And if you missed any of our interviews today, whether it was Byron or Amin, both were fantastic, told great stories. Check out the entire Interview on Demand section for the Sedano Show podcast, brought to you by Capital One Quicksilver Card, earning unlimited 1.5% cash back on every purchase everywhere. What's in your wallet? You can check it out on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, wherever you find your podcasts. So, Bergman, before I get, we only have like 5 minutes here. So, before I get into Clayton Kershaw real quick, you have the story of the origination of 420. Today is 420 day. Happy 420 to everyone. Bergman, what is the origin of 420?
So, okay. So, in 1971, there was these five high school students in San Rafael, California. They called themselves the Waldos. And they would say, hey, let's meet at 420 at this place because they had a plan to search for an abandoned cannabis crop based on a treasure map by the grower. So, they would always meet at 420. And they would just – eventually, they just said, hey, just meet at 420, meet at 420. And someone at High Times – found out about it, and they
right. Just this is a word spread, right?
The word spread to the High Times about the Waldos, and eventually it ended up going to the Grateful Dead followers, and then they started getting the Grateful Dead started putting 420 on their posters, and it just blew up bigger and bigger and bigger into the socially accepted hour of the day to consume cannabis.
Now it's funny you mention High Times. Does High Times still exist? Like the publication?
I think so. I don't see why it wouldn't. Let's see. I mean,
you can look it up for a second. I got a funny story about High Times. So Pat Riley once told me a story that when he was coaching the Lakers, he had come back through LAX or something like that. He was on vacation with him and his wife Chris or whatever, and they were at the getting their luggage, and a guy came up to him and said, "Coach, I'm a big Laker fan. Can you take a picture of?" With me here. Like, I'd love to just take a picture with you. He's like, yeah, sure, no problem. So he takes a picture, puts his arm around the guy, and then he doesn't think anything of it. And then lo and behold, a few weeks later, he's in High Times with the guy because the guy was like either the publisher or somebody who worked at the magazine. But he told me the story that he was in High Times because the guy convinced him to take a picture. He had no idea. He just thought he was taking a picture with somebody.
Oh, no.
It's pretty hilarious, actually. It's a funny, funny story. But, so when you said High Times, it made me think of that story that Riley told me a long time ago.
Yeah, but High Times is still in existence, and they just acquired another cannabis company. So, yeah, they're still going.
Yeah. Bergman, Mason will clearly partake. Now, will Mason partake on 420 at 420 on the show?
I think he may have woken up at 420 in the morning so he could do both. Oh. Wake up at 420, smoke, go to bed, come back, wake up. And in the middle of his show at 4:20, because he's on from 3 to 6:30,
he
may do it again. No, he's gonna be like, hey, let me just step away for a few minutes.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. We should have Mason on tomorrow to talk about how he celebrated 4:20. Bergman, yes, no?
No, I used to when I was younger, and I have not touched it in easily 10-plus years.
Why? Just what happened?
I eventually started becoming paranoid. And,
oh, you? Paranoid? Shocker.
I know. Shocking, right? Yeah. Thanks a lot. Appreciate that, by the way. But yeah, I got paranoid. I was like, I'm done. I like drinking more because it's social, and I became unsocial, and I didn't like that.
Oh, yeah. Well, if you become unsocial, there's no point in that. So anyway.
No.
All right. Well, happy 420.
So you're big into it.
How do you know I'm not right now?
I think you are.
Kidding. It's happy 420. You guys enjoy, man. You know what I mean? Like, enjoy life, like Byron said. I think Byron said a number of really cool things, including just enjoy your life, stay inside, listen to everybody, the government and the governors and the mayor. They know what's best for us right now. Listen to them, okay? So thank you, guys. Thanks to Byron. Thanks to Amin. Thanks to Bergman and Laura. Thanks to you guys for tuning in, calling in. We love you. We'll talk to you tomorrow at 10. See ya.